Welcome to the Mind Stogie Mr. Goji podcast with your hosts, Don Gonzalez
and Mark Connolly,
where we get together and discuss everything from the sublime
to the ridiculous.
Hello, this is Don Gonzalez, co-host and novice producer of Mind Stogie Mr. Goji. Before you listen to this episode, I just want to apologize for the sound quality. We were using a backup recording system, and it seems that the mics weren't picking up the sound, and rather we were recording directly to our recording device, which means some of the levels are uneven. I did the best I could to even them out, so I apologize for that. And you're going to hear some ambient noise in the background. It's family members. Nothing that bleeds into the conversation. I think the conversation will still hold up. We promise that in shows upcoming, we'll be more intentional about making sure that the mics and everything are working correctly. Again, I apologize and thank you for continuing to listen to our little program. Thank you. Welcome back to the My Stogie Mr. Goji podcast. As always, our first segment is what you drinking and what you smoking. Mark, we'll start with you.
All right. Well, I am drinking Glenmorangie 10-year-old. It's something we've had a few times. We enjoy it. It's a nice, reliable scotch. And I am smoking a Christmas gift that I got from my son, Leon. And it is a cigar that is actually made here in Farmers Branch, Texas, which is a suburb a little bit south of Carrollton. It's made at the House of Cigars factory, and it is a Connecticut shade wrapper. I do not know what the tobaccos are. I would assume they're either Dominican or Nicaraguan, but I don't know. And it's called La Jefa. But I don't know if that means that's who made it, because there's a woman there that rolls cigars, or if that's what they just called the cigar. There's a note here that says it's a Corona, but it doesn't really look like a Corona to me. Well, it looks, you made the comment, it looks like a Lancero. So it's probably maybe a 40 ring gauge, and I'm going to guess 6.5 inches long, maybe 7.
Yeah.
It's smoking very... very light, smooth. It was a pigtail end, and I just twisted the end off because I overheard somebody talking about that at the Big Smoke. Instead of clipping it, you can just twist the end off, so that's what I did. And at first I thought the draw was going to be a little bit tight, but it's actually fine. I'm taking hints of smoke and warmth to pair with my Glenmorangie, which is okay, really oddly, I got like a hint of apricot there for some reason.
Okay.
So, I don't know what to say about that. I don't get much peat out of this scotch.
No, the normal one, almost never. And I think there's a reason. I did a little bit of research on it this time, and I'll talk about it when I talk about my cigar. Kevin, if you talk loud enough, I can pick you up on this mic. What are you smoking?
I am smoking Alec Bradley Magic Toast. And I've paired it with a Coca-Cola Classic.
All right. You sometimes have a palate. Are you picking up any flavors on the cigar?
I am actually picking up toast. The cigar on the front end is just a smooth flavoring of just tobacco. But then on the back end, literally like towards the back of my throat, there's an actual toast taste that's coming through. I've mentioned, I think, before we got started that you have that perfect level of toast, and then there's that 10-second too long, and now it's all jacked up. It's like right there, and it's just a split second of that, but it's pretty cool.
Good. All right. Well, I, too, am drinking the Glenmorangie 10, and if you ever... the bottles, they almost always come in a box, the 750 milliliters, and they're orange, and part of the reason why they're orange is it's a nod to their stills.
they distill the whiskey in giraffe high stills, is the way they describe it.
That's a tall still.
Yeah. And so they're aged in bourbon casks. And like we said, it's a 10-year-old. So it's common, we've talked before about picking up orangey hints. I always pick that up. A little bit of honey or vanilla. And I think the apricot that you're picking up is probably closer to peach. But it could be apricot too. Apricot and peach have a very similar profile.
I will take your word for that.
And I am smoking an Arturo Fuente.
No way.
Hemingway series, work of art, Maduro.
Oh.
Okay, yeah, so wow. Mixing it up a little bit. So this is what is called a figurado. And it is a, its length is 4 7/8, and it's a 60 ring gauge at its widest point, and it tapers down, which does affect the flavor of the cigar as you progress through it. The wrapper is Connecticut broadleaf, and it's different from the regular one. The regular uses a Cameroon, so this is a Connecticut broadleaf. And the filler is the same filler as the regular one, which is Dominican from the Fuente, Chateau de Fuente. It's about it's a medium strength cigar, and the price point on this is about somewhere between $11 and $12. I bought it as part of a sampler because two of the samples of the work of art were the rare pinks. So I think we'll be reviewing that. I don't know. It depends on what your New Year's Day schedule is like. And I thought we might have a coupon. Might pick up that bottle of McAllen 12 or 18.
Oh, all right.
I thought we'd start with the 12 because the 12 is pretty good. And you got me that for my birthday. So.
Sounds like a plan.
So right off the bat on this, I'm picking up hints of leather, maybe a little bit of dark chocolate. Right. So this is a good solid cigar, as all the Fuentes are. We'll come back at the end to see if we have any other comments about the cigars. So last week we talked about the liturgical challenge of the fourth Sunday of Advent falling on Christmas Eve and not being able to get two for the price of one.
Right.
So before we get into our main topic, I just like to go around the horn, as they say, and ask how everybody was able to maneuver through that. Start with you, Mark.
I did the long weekend version, which was the Christmas, or the anticipatory Mass on Saturday, and then like the 11 o'clock Mass on Christmas Day. Or was it 10? I can't remember. 10 or 11.
If you do it at St. Cat's, it's 11.
Yeah.
Now, were you able to do that? Because in your family, the big celebration is at night, right?
Yeah, there was no way to make any of the evening masses. So we cook a prime rib. We had 16 adults and 11 kids here. And there's just no way to get anywhere on Christmas Eve.
And it's called the Noche Buena, right?
Yep, that's right. So we have a blending of traditions. So we cook the prime rib. That's an every year thing. We cook a prime rib because it's easy. It's kind of an expensive piece of meat, but it's real easy to cook. We use what's called a closed oven method, where you stick it in the oven at 500 degrees for a length of time that depends on how many pounds it is, and then you just turn the oven off and wait 2 hours. And it comes out basically perfect. So it's almost a brainless piece of meat to cook. And then I convinced Rosie not to kill herself this year with extravagant desserts, but she did make an onion tart thing. It was actually pretty good. It was an onion tart with balsamic vinegar and olive oil and thyme with a slice of onion and then some puff pastry wrapped around it. And then you bake it in the oven and the onion gets caramelized. And then when you serve it, you turn it over and then you eat that. Anyway, it was delicious. So, and then because my dad is married to a woman from England, we have a tradition of the poppers. And so after everybody finishes eating, you pull the popper, and it has little paper crowns in it that I make everybody put on. Nobody really wants to, but I make them wear them for a little while. It's my house, my rules, I guess. And then they have dumb jokes in them, and usually some kind of a toy. And so it'll be one of those little metal puzzles where you have to take something apart and then try to put it back together. Or it'll be some sort of die game, something like that. So anyway, that's what we do. And then we sit around and talk, and it can go on for quite a while. So fortunately, this year, we actually wrapped everything before. There's been a few Christmases where I've been up till 2 or 3 in the morning wrapping presents. This year, we were all done. And so Christmas morning, you wake up, and we come down, and our tradition here is you get to open the stockings first, or empty the stockings or whatever. And that was a tradition from when I was a kid, because Dad... I know now why he never got up early on Christmas morning, but we would be allowed to get into our stockings if Dad wasn't awake yet. But we had to wait on the presents until Dad came out. So right. That's just what we do here. So if you come down early, you can get in your stocking.
I think a lot of people have that tradition.
Yeah.
Dad's up putting the bike together or whatever.
Right, to be done. Exactly. So,
Kevin, how did you maneuver it?
So we, for the fourth Sunday of Advent, we did Saturday night.
The vigil.
The vigil. So it was at 5 o'clock. And then for Christmas, we did the vigil at 6:30 on Sunday.
Okay.
So that was mainly for the sake of our daughter, because she's 8. So I didn't want to cram 2 masses in one day. And try to make sure that she's as attentive as she needs to be and participating and whatnot. And it worked out really well. We don't do a lot around Christmas. We have our traditional grandparents breakfast on Christmas Day. And that's really it. So
what's the traditional breakfast foods? Or is it just a tradition to have a big breakfast?
There's usually going to be scrambled eggs, bacon, sausage, at least a couple types of pigs in the blanket, biscuits, and then at some point somebody generally gets some cinnamon rolls going. So usually there's some kind of morning approved alcoholic beverages for the adults.
Like mimosas or something?
We've done mimosas. This year my mom and I had eggnog with some Baileys in it.
Okay. Baileys. Wow, that's 2 heavy, creamy things mixed together.
That's what Mom said. Mom says, he's like, that's going to be too heavy. And I was like, well, let's find out. Mixed it up. Took a sip. I'm like, I'm good.
She also made an apple juice mimosa.
Really?
Yeah, which she apparently liked. I thought that's a lot of sugar.
Well, I guess real orange juice has quite a bit of sugar in it, too.
Yeah, but it has some acidity to it, too. Yeah. It kind of balances out a little bit. I don't know.
So what time does this breakfast start every Christmas morning?
I had Kate look it up because I wasn't sure. And it turns out 9:30.
Okay.
I think there was one year we did it like closer to 10, but 9:30 to 10 o'clock time frame.
So I will say this, next year I've pleaded with Rosie to do my family's traditional Christmas Eve, which is... almost nothing. Hot dogs for dinner in Shirley Temple's to drink in front of the fire. At least that's what we did for the kids. Ginger ale and cherries. Maraschino cherries. And just relax. And then I'll probably try to go to whatever the latest mass is I can find next year. I would like to go to a midnight mass because I haven't been to one in 40 years.
St. Anne does a proper midnight mass. They start caroling at 11, and then mass starts at midnight.
Wow.
What we did is we went to the Saturday night vigil mass, which was packed. And I don't think the church people anticipated how packed it was going to be.
Wow.
It overflowed into the chapel and into the plaza area.
Wow.
They ran out of communion. They had to go to the tabernacle and pull from the reserves and start breaking up the host in half.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's a good problem to have. I think a lot of people have the same idea that Stacy and I have.
Yeah.
And originally we were going to do the 6 p.m. Mass, but I got it in my head. I was like, that 4 o'clock Mass is all. I didn't realize it was the children's Mass, and that's the reason why it's the biggest Mass. And I decided to make a pivot, and we do the 4 o'clock Mass. But what happened, so we got there at 3, and the parking lot was still full for the 2 o'clock Spanish Mass, which was the last Advent Mass at the church. So we had to park across the street at it's a high school, and we walked across and we were able to get in, and we got in early enough to be able to get seats, but it quickly filled up. There were people waiting to go in to the church. And at one point, Father announced that we had the whole church full, the chapel, our two big assembly rooms, which one holds 700, the other one holds 500. And they calculated, because I guess the ushers have to click, 500 people out in the plaza. So we had close to 3,000 people at that Mass.
Wow.
So one of the cool things that I don't know if they did this during COVID. I think they did. They've got two really large screens mounted on the outside of the church facing the plaza. And they stream the Mass there. So you can watch everything that's going on while you're out in the plaza.
Wow.
And they stream it into the assembly rooms as well. But in those rooms, I mean, it's very organized. They have EMs that are allotted for each of those facilities. So Mass was really right at an hour.
Wow. That's amazing.
So it worked out well. And then afterwards, we went and had dinner afterwards and then went over to Kevin's in the morning. And really, doing the vigil Mass is the only way that we can really make it to the grandparents' breakfast. And it's a lot of fun. And I think it's cool that Kevin did that because it creates less stress for the grandparents vying for who's going to get time with the grandkid.
Right.
And then one of the things that we do in our family, because all three of my kids are grown, and at least, well, the two other sets of in-laws are out of town. So we just let them celebrate Christmas with in-laws or whatever. And then on January 6th or thereabouts, we celebrate our gift giving. And traditionally, we do a Mexican meal. Sometimes Kevin cooks tacos. This year, Stacy's going to make chicken enchiladas. Everybody brings a side dish. And last year, we started a tradition playing Loteria, which is Mexican bingo. And we play for gift cards. And then we add a white elephant element to it so that when you win, you can steal from the other person or take from the pile. And I introduced that concept so we could get away from everybody just exchanging gift cards from adults and being worried about buying every single adult something. This way you're only out 25 or 50 bucks. So everybody seemed to enjoy it last year. So
we did something that was a variation on that white elephant gift exchange. Because the very first time I ever did a white elephant gift exchange, I thought it was a lot of fun. It was very inappropriately, I guess, called a Chinese gift exchange back then. That's how I always heard of it until recently. Then it turned into a white elephant gift exchange. But one of the issues there is, you give everybody a dollar value that they're supposed to stay within, and somebody goes out and buys, it's kind of like
Michael Scott
in The Office, mm-hmm. where somebody buys somebody an iPod or whatever, or iPad, and then somebody else brings a toilet seat. there's this disparity in the presents, and so I've grown weary of that whole event. But this year, what they did was they just told everybody to buy crazy socks. And so you picked out crazy socks. And about the first nine people just kept their socks, and then somebody started to steal. And then it got fun because people, you got to see what kind of socks people were interested in. And there was even this thing where my brother-in-law, Robert, also smoked cigars, and his daughter-in-law, Jamie, had bought cigars, socks that said, "I smoke cigars and I know things." Well, he had gotten them, and then they were stolen from him, and then his grandson stole them back, and at the end of the night, he just gave them to his grandfather.
That's cool.
So, and I had the opportunity to steal them from Dominic, but I thought, no, I know he wants to give those to his grandfather, so I picked up some other socks. So that was kind of fun.
Yeah. So last thing I want to say before we move on to our main topic is, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, we talked at length last week about trying to be charitable and hospitable to the creasters. And I don't think the people that were sitting behind us were creasters necessarily, but they had to be the loudest people on the planet. They talked. So since it was the children's mass, they started off 15 to 20 minutes before mass with caroling from the children.
Oh, wow.
It was done with intentionality. Every song tells the story leading up to the birth.
Ah.
And I wish I brought the list with me. It was pretty cool the way the music director did that. But this lady behind us with this thick New York accent was talking throughout the entire time. And I was like, man, if this lady doesn't, if she does this during mass, I'm going to have to turn around and say something. But fortunately, she was quiet during mass and all was well.
Wow.
So it was funny, too, because I overheard a conversation between her and one of the other ladies that they hadn't made it to mass for Sunday or Sunday in the morning. And then they seemed to think that watching it on TV would be okay too, which they didn't do that either. Mm. And I was like, I started turning around and say, you know, this can count for your Sunday, but then you still have to go tomorrow. And I was like, not my place. Maybe it was my place, I don't know. But I didn't.
Well, you did better than I did, because I didn't really remember any of our conversation. I wasn't intentional about it at all. I think I was just a little bit too preoccupied with everything that had to be done here.
Sure. Well, to be fair, they did the whole welcoming thing, and then I'm on the back end of a sinus infection, so the young couple in front of us wanted to shake hands at the very beginning, and I gave them the old wave. And, you know, there's not enough time in that brief moment to say, hey, look, I've been sick, I don't want to shake your hand.
But yeah.
It is what it is. Anyway. Well, for the record, since a lot of people are already taking down their Christmas lights, Christmas time is a season, and depending on how you celebrate it, there are 7 more days of Christmas. The modern calendar concludes Christmas time on January 6th with the Epiphany. The old calendar ends with the Candlemas on it's February 2nd or February, I think it's February 2nd.
I think that's right.
So, anyway, we did an old podcast on that, and I'll try to link to it about the different, there are at least 4 different presentations of our Lord. And so that's February the 2nd is the Feast of the Presentation.
So I'll just add this little side note. In Cuba, they don't really do the Santa Claus thing. And I think this may be true in a lot of South America. The day of the presents is on the Epiphany, because that's when the 3 kings arrived with their gifts.
Right. And that's
so that's when they do that.
That's why we picked that day for our gift giving.
Yeah.
You know, originally it was unintentional, and then I woke up one day and said, hey, this is close to Epiphany. So we do it then. To kind of tie into a little bit of my cultural background, although we never did that as a family, but it makes sense. And we were already doing Mexican food and all that, so just add a little bit more to it. And the added bonus is it's actually my baptism day. I was baptized on January 6th. So. So in my head, we're celebrating my baptism day, too.
There you go. So. Well, today's the Feast of Stephen.
Yes.
Which, when I was a kid growing up, I never quite understood the Good King Wenceslas song. But Good King Wenceslas looked out on the Feast of Stephen when the snow lay round about, cool and crisp and even. Have you ever heard that song?
Yes.
So, I didn't put two and two together until, I don't know, 2 years ago. So.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you bring that up because liturgically, so one of the things I do, I don't know that I've talked about this on a podcast, but I journal my meditations on the daily readings every day in a journal. And since one of the things that I did in order to kind of control my spending on fountain pens and fountain pen inks is I capped it at liturgical colors. So during the ordinary time, I'll write with a green fountain pen with a different type of green fountain pen ink.
Yeah.
So know that's your favorite color to write with. I've learned to like that color. And then during Lent and Advent, I write with purple. And then on Solemnities, I have found some gold inks.
Oh, wow.
And then on Martyrs, I use a red ink. And it occurred to me, so today was red, and in 2 days it's going to be red again because it's the, what are they called? They call them the Holy Martyrs or the Unborn Martyrs? The Holy Innocents. The Holy Innocents, that's what it's called. So that's in 2 days. So right off the bat, during Christmas time, we have two celebrations of martyrs.
Wow.
I think it's interesting. Anyway, so I asked for us to talk, and I think this is a nice continuation of the talk that we had last week. And it's this notion of hospitality and inclusivity and welcoming environments. And I think as I was thinking about it earlier today, I think it really comes down to this idea of community. And the question that I was meditating on, is it something unique about Catholics that we don't tend to be very friendly? Like, it's like, go to Mass, leave, there's no interaction, there's like, yeah, of course, you got little cliques of people that talk to each other, but outside of that, there's not. And then, and there are a couple of stories that we're going to share that made me think that there's not a lot of depth to these relationships. But the other thought I was having, is this a Catholic thing or is this an American thing? And I'm wondering if it's true in other churches as well. So I'm going to ask Kevin to share a story that he shared at breakfast the other day. But before I get to that, I want to frame all of this in the context of pastoral theology. So you and I have degrees in pastoral theology. And I don't know about you, but when I first heard about the program, I was like leery of it.
Right.
Because I thought of pastoral theology as being this touchy-feely sort of thing. I associated it with, like, you know, all the bad things that are associated with social justice and watering down Catholic teaching. That's kind of the mindset I had. And I don't think I had a great enough appreciation for it while we were going through the process. But in getting ready for tonight, I had an aha moment. In order to study pastoral theology, you need to have an understanding of canon law, moral theology, dogmatic theology. And guess what? We did all of that.
Yeah.
Because pastoral theology serves all of the other, what they call theological sciences. So what I read on the Catholic Encyclopedia is that pastoral theology begins where the other theological sciences end. And what I wrote in my own notes is from the classroom to the streets. Like, pastoral theology is where you take where you take canon law, where you take dogmatic theology and moral theology and spiritual theology, and you take it to where the people are. And it's a form of what they call practical theology. And we always talked about meeting people where they are.
Yeah, I would call it applied theology.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it too. And all towards the care of souls, is the final sentence was. So I think that this topic fits into that framework of pastoral theology. And the thing that I was thinking about is when we think about we're all called to be priest, prophet, and king, that we have those roles, like the priestly ministry requires the pastoral component as well. And I don't know that we do a good enough job of that. So that's kind of the framework for the discussion. So I'd like to start with Kevin sharing his story from breakfast. And I'll share my story as well. Maybe that'll be a good launching pad to what it is that my concern is. And then maybe that'll make you think of something that's happened that you've seen before, either in a positive or negative way.
All right.
Kevin?
So my church participates in Matthew Kelly's program, Welcome, which was formerly known as CHRP, Christ Renews His Parish. And two of the main goals of Welcome is to get people involved in the life of the parish and to become, Matthew Kelly puts it, the best version of yourself. And through the Welcome program, a lot of men grow bonds with one another, they grow there's friendships that are developed. And this past week, we were called upon to care for one of our brothers, whose brother-in-law died suddenly and unexpectedly. And the first call that he put out was for men to attend the rosary during the visitation and to attend the funeral. I don't know how many people reached out to him one-on-one, but I do know that there were only three of us out of 30-plus men who know this gentleman that showed up at the Mass. And then the same gentleman for Christmas put out a call for somebody to sit with him at Mass during the whole funeral.
I think it's important that you point out how this call was made out.
It was through a
group text.
A group text, yeah.
That y'all are all part of.
Correct. And it spreads across multiple teams, so it's not just like one or two teams. There's 5 to 6 teams on here, and this gentleman is part of the continuation committee, so most of these men are familiar with him. And his family had all gotten sick during the whole funeral and memorial and all that stuff.
When was the funeral?
About a week ago.
Okay.
And so they're all still recovering, and so he's going to end up being at Mass by himself, and he's still bummed out. And so he flat out said, I don't want to sit alone. Who's going to be at this Mass? Well, we'd already decided we weren't going to be at that Mass. We were going to be at a later Mass. And so I told him, I said, hey, if you haven't left the house yet, I've got a seat for you. Well, he was already at the church. Well, several men had confirmed they were going to be at that Mass, and not one man stepped forward to say, hey, come sit with us. And he notified everybody that he sat alone. And that rubbed me. It rubbed me raw. Because out of all, I've had conversations with these guys, and I've had this thought before, that we as a Catholic community, we don't, and I've heard it from non-Catholics as well, that have been to a Mass or have experienced the Catholic faith in some way, shape, or fashion, is that we'd go to Mass and we bounce. I mean, sometimes you don't have to look any further than the parking lot to see that something didn't sync with some people, right? Cutting people off, flying out of the parking lot, like, all right, I gave God his hour, time to jet, I got a football game or whatever to catch. But I always had in my mind that when it comes to your friends, men who you've proclaimed to love, that kind of mentality need not apply. Mm. And to experience that firsthand, he hit me up one-on-one and had some words that weren't aimed at me, but they caused more discomfort. And originally, I was going to leave it alone and hit guys one-on-one But I did go to the same group text and speak my mind. I didn't use his name. I didn't use the situation. I didn't call anybody out. I spoke in generalities. But I made it very clear that we suck at being there for one another when it matters most. That it's all hunky-dory that we have individual... Some guys are closer to other guys, right? So you have certain men that, you know, I've got probably four of these guys that I'd say I'm really close to. Top tier friends at this point. And then I've got other guys who I know, who I love, who I'll hang out with in a heartbeat. But they're in the lower totem pole, the friendship, right? It's not a bad thing. It's not a good thing. It just is what it is. And so I understand there's that dynamic, right? And then not all guys are comfortable reaching out on that intimate level. But the fact remains is you have at least two men that care about you and love you in any group. And those men should be reaching out, especially when there's a direct call.
Yeah.
You know, we always put on there, oh, we'll pray for one another. But I was like, how many of us are actually doing that? Because I confessed in this text. I said, look, I'm bad at that. I'll say I'll pray for you all day long. Honestly, I'm probably 65% on that. Right? But then how many of us are doing personal check-ins post-fact? Oh, I prayed for you. But how many of us are going back afterwards and going, hey man, we said this prayer for you. How's that situation? How are you doing?
Yeah.
And so I just put it out there. I said, we need to do better. I'm vowing to do better. Here's my phone number if you don't have it. Whatever you need, you call on me. And if it's within my power, then I pray that God give me the graces and blessings that I need to fulfill whatever it is that God wants me to do for your situation. But if nothing else, I'm going to check on you. Because we always, like Dad said earlier, we're always talking to each other after Mass. It's St. Jude's, whenever Mass is over, you see the clicks. And I've become intentional about engaging people I don't know because it's a weak spot for me. People are always like, oh, but you get up there and you read at the Ambo and you have a theater background. I'm like, it's different. Right? It's not that intimacy that you have to greet a stranger.
Yeah.
To just say, hey, I'm glad you're here. It's good to see you. Right? So you see the clicks and the pockets, but then you see some of these people talking to some of these guys, and then I know that some of these people are the same people that weren't there in this particular situation. And it just, we as Catholics, we as Christians, we have to do better.
So when he brought this up at breakfast, he said, I know what you mean. And he was referencing two stories that I told before. I've told a story, I think I told it on the podcast before, about a friend of mine who was like a fourth degree knight, very involved in his prayers, played the piano at Mass, had a crisis of faith, where he was wrestling with something, and he wrongly interpreted that wrestling with him rejecting Catholic teaching and just stopped going to Mass. Mm-hmm. Just stopped everything. And nobody reached out to him. He just dropped off the planet and nobody bothered to ask, where are you? What's going on with you? And I fast forward to a couple of years ago when I decided to leave St. Catherine's to go to St. Jude's with Kevin. It was not that long after that Mom died, and no one from that parish, except for the people that I reached out to participate in the Mass, reached out at all. In fact, besides the people at Joe Catholic that were at that Joe Catholic meeting, nobody in that parish knew why we were leaving. And so when we left the parish, and I was very involved in that parish. You know, I was a big part of adult formation across the board. And at one time I was on the continuation committee for CHIRP. I was on the pastoral council for a little bit. And not one person from that parish reached out. And I'm like, and what hit me was like, yeah, I was a little bit hurt by it. But the people that mattered, you know, that I have in my life, you know, like you, were there for me. But it occurred to me, like, if somebody who was as involved and invested as I was doesn't have people reaching out to him. What happens to the person who sits next to you at church who just suddenly stops coming? But, you know, people don't really know that they're involved or whatever. That person doesn't have a chance of anybody reaching out to them. So it's like, where's the community?
Well, you made me think of two things. And one of them happened a long time ago, and the other one's a song. But years ago, a person at St. Catherine's wife passed away. And I knew the person, but I just knew him. I didn't interact with him. I wasn't friends with him. I would say hi at Mass, and that was about it. And I got a call to be a pallbearer. And so I went and did the pallbearer thing at the funeral. But why did he have to call me? Why did he not have... I mean, he was a Knight of Columbus and all of that. The fact that I was called makes me think he didn't have anybody. And my guess is he was going down the list and got to the C's and called, and I said, okay. Because I can't think of any other reason why he would have selected me to be a pallbearer. Because I'm not in his circle. I'm not a family friend. I'm a parishioner, and that's it. And so just this conversation just made me think of that. I'm like going, wow. Well, he had to call it basically a stranger to be a pallbearer at his wife's funeral. That's strange to me.
Yeah.
So I remember that, and it speaks to this whole where's the community. The other thing is I just thought of that song Eleanor Rigby. You know, she died and nobody came. Right? And I'm guessing that's in England, because it's a Beatles song, and so it would have been Church of England or whatever, most likely. But it says something about all the lonely people. Where do they all come from?
Well, I mean, I think there are two different things happening that we're discussing. I think there's one component, and that's the lack of friendship in general.
Yeah.
I think that people lack friendships, real authentic friendships.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one thing that's happening that really describes the situation that you're describing. But then I guess the other question that comes to mind for me with this experience is that Kevin and I have had, and my friend had, as it relates to the church community, is like, do the people have a responsibility? Are we asking too much of them to care about stuff like that? I guess, you know, like, and I'm trying to be very charitable about all of this, because there are only a handful of people at St. Anne's that even know who I am. And at the point that I'm at right now at that church, my relationships with people are very superficial. I mean, I've had coffee with one guy there who's also part of my small group at the Encounter School. Short of that, no one there really knows me. So I wouldn't expect anything. But when I was at St. Catherine, it's a much smaller parish. People do know each other, and people do see each other. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, am I being unfair? Is Kevin being unfair, expecting that people should step up and care about that sort of thing?
I think that what we're talking about here is a larger problem than just a Catholic church. But I think it manifests for us in the Catholic Church, because we're talking about community and the importance of community and the importance of friendship. And so I think it's right and proper for us to look at our church and go, are we living the way we're supposed to live? And I was thinking about, there's a couple of people that Rosie and I had become kind of friends with at St. Catherine's. and even been to their house. There was a little group for a while that would rotate dinners. But after that stopped, we didn't stay in contact with any of them. And I mean, I'm saying Rosie and I didn't stay in contact with them. It was four couples. None of the other three couples stayed in contact with us. I don't know if they stayed in contact with each other. I think possibly two of the couples were already friends, and so that may be the case. But we didn't develop any kind of a friendship. And as I sit here and try to think about how or why, I don't know. We enjoyed it when they were over here, and we enjoyed it when we went to their house. But we never felt like developing a friendship. And so there's the people in need, and then there's the friendship aspect. I think we do have a friendship problem in this country. I think that people don't have a lot of real friends, but I don't know how many real friends you can have. So are we talking about friendship, or are we just talking about like a duty that we should have toward our fellow man? No, I don't know the answer to that, because I'm thinking about it right now as we're talking about it. I mean, within the laity, there is a very intentional pillar of community, and you know, there is an effort, because it's part of our charism, to stay in contact with people. And when somebody's fallen off, somebody calls them. I make an effort to call them, or somebody who knows them calls them. And like, there's one guy in particular. He and I both took our permanent promise, or our temporary promises, on the same Sunday. And he hasn't been coming. And I finally reached out to him, and he said, you know, he misses it. He's in the middle of a PhD program. He's up in Denton. He doesn't have a car, and he just hadn't been able to come. He's out of time. He has no time, and he has no means, and nobody lives out that way to bring him. But he thanked me for reaching out to him. But again, that's within that Dominican lay apostolate, if you will. And so, how many people do we feel responsible for that aren't our friends? And that just made me think of the Good Samaritan, you know, and the question was, who was whose neighbor? And so, I don't think it's just about being friends. I think there's a duty that we're ignoring.
See, I agree. And I think there's, with modern technology, there's not a lot of excuses, because we're not, at least in my mind, I'm not asking much. I'm asking someone to send a text, make a phone call, fire off an email, see them in church, and be intentional once. You know, I think the friendship aspect is there. And when I talked about the friendship, for me in particular, it was just a matter of the dynamic the friendships play in a given situation. My call, though, is to the duty aspect. That, to your point, you talked about one of my original drafts of the guys in the group text that accidentally got deleted had several scripture references in it, where we're told in scripture to care for one another.
Right.
Whether it be one of us has fallen into sin, one of us has a need, whatever the case is, even at its foundation, what did Jesus say to do more than anything else but love one another? Treat others as you would want yourself to be treated. Right? So if I'm dealing with suffering, and I'm dealing with sorrow or whatever, and I put a cry out for help saying, hey, I'm going to be at this mass, my family can't be there, I just want to be able to sit with somebody who I know, who I'm acquainted with, or yeah, even one of my closer friends, then I don't think it's asking too much for someone to go, sure, you can sit next to me. What difference does it make to you, whether it's me, someone who needs that, versus a complete stranger?
I think people don't like to be told they have a duty. Duty does not seem to be a virtue that's valued in this country anymore.
But we've forgotten that rights come with duties.
Yeah. Well, we have rights because we have duties.
Right. I mean, that's the Catholic view.
Right.
The American view is supposed to be founded on the idea that rights come with responsibilities.
Right.
Well, the only thought that I had is that I do know when you make efforts, you see fruits, and you can see fruits very quickly. I shared a couple of weeks ago that it really, the death of this teacher that at our school, that I was never Christ to her.
Yeah.
I tried to avoid her. Sometimes I was rude to her. But I had an immediate thought. It was like, well, I can't do anything about that. I mean, I pray for her soul at every Mass. But I have other teachers like that, that are in my sphere of influence, that I can witness to. And one person in particular, I talked a little bit about him. And I started being intentional about having conversations with him at school. And I know he's not a believer. So on the 23rd, I sent him a Happy Festivus.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I think I sent you the same text. It was basically like, may your day be filled with feats of strength and the airing out of grievances. And he laughed and he sent me back a meme. But here's the funny part. This non-believer was the first person to send me a Merry Christmas text on Christmas Day.
Wow.
So something has happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it's small. But it's like when you plant those seeds, what is it? The little sapling.
Right.
Has started to sprout.
Yep.
And so, it gives me hope. So, I guess what I'm saying with all of this is that, I guess it starts with one person at a time, trying to be the model for other people. And talking about it, I think, Kevin, you know, I don't know, you know, if your text was more charitable than a text that I would send out, because I tend to be still too harsh and stuff like that, and hopefully
a verbal headbutt.
Yes.
So I will say that although I didn't speak to anybody or any particular situation, the gentleman in question knew what it was about, and he sent me a gratitude text. And, you know, talking about starting with one person at a time, just sitting here having this conversation made me realize something that I can do better, and that's greet the strangers at church. Before Mass, after Mass, just say, hey, it's great to see you today. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. Just something little, quick, nothing to hold them up from leaving. Just something that could potentially just stick.
Well, we can do that everywhere.
Sure.
Because I was having a conversation with your mom yesterday over dinner about how it is that when I go to my Starbucks in the morning, and normally it's like 5:30 in the morning, how I get greeted like Norm at Cheers.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, they do that with everyone. I said, no, they don't. There are other regulars that come in that they don't treat that way. And I said, I think I know what it is. I said, I treat them like people.
Yeah.
I knew one of them whose name is Tiffany, and our daughter's named Tiffany. And right. For my first conversation was, oh, I have a daughter named Tiffany. And then she'd ask me about my week or my weekend, and then I would reciprocate. What do you've got going on? And I remember her telling me that she was starting a program to be a volunteer for CASA, which is a child advocacy program.
Right.
So a week later, I asked her how the training was going. And she lit up because I took an interest. And I've done that with all of the different baristas. So I think I've just kind of developed this reputation as a friendly guy. So the moment I walk in, they're like, every single one of them is like, hi, Don. Even the ones I don't know yet. So,
really?
Yeah, there's a newish barista there now that knows me by name. And I'm always very intentional about saying, good morning, have a great day. And as I'm waiting for my coffee or my food, I'm just engage them in a little conversation if they're not busy. And I think these are the things that we can do. And the other thing that we can do is that people love to hear their names. Like if you go to, you know, like Taco Casa and you get your tacos, thank you, Leonard.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever.
Throws them off when they do that. You're the reason I do that, by the way. I will intentionally go for people's name tags so I could do that. But your Starbucks story reminds me. I go to Taco Cabana every Monday morning for breakfast. That's my little go-to. So much so that one of the main guys that takes care of me, I'll roll up and he goes, salsa fuego? Because that's my salsa. I don't like the regular. I'll take it, but I prefer the fuego. Well, one day, I ordered sweet tea to drink. And they didn't say anything about it. And I get up to the window and I see the tea container sitting up on their counter. And I was like, no, they're not. Sure enough, they didn't have any sweet tea ready. They made a very quick batch. I know because there was sugar. I was getting the sugar flakes. But they made it for me.
Instead of saying, oh, we don't
have any. Instead of saying, we don't have any.
Yeah.
They recognize my voice or my order because I always order the same thing. And they're like, no, no, no. This cat's getting sweet tea. And even though it was rust and it wasn't perfect, I gave great thanks for it.
Yeah, and you weren't nice so that you could get that, but that's the fruits of you being nice.
Yeah.
Because to your point, I'm always deliberate about asking them how their morning's going, thanking them for their service before I leave.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's funny though to me that I could do that there, but you put me in like other situations and somebody's like, oh, can't do it. So I'm going to put pressure on myself.
Leave your comfort zone a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, it's a fun game that we can play with ourselves to just do that. And you touch people's lives. A little smile.
Well, and I think the difference maker is somebody at the Starbucks can go, how are you doing? You go, I'm fine. Or, and you go, I'm fine, thank you, how are you? But you don't really care. You just, you know, that's just a parroting of, you know, a social nicety. But they go, how are you doing? You go, yeah, I'm doing really well. You know, this happened today. And how's your day? And what are you doing this weekend? And it's genuine. There's an actual interest. That's the game changer. And I think that's why they all know you there. Because it's genuine. You've got me really thinking about duties. And I'm kind of, I don't normally do New Year's resolutions. Because I learned a long time ago they're basically crap. You know, so, and you can tell, I was telling Ernesto, because Ernesto goes to the gym at the Carrollton Rec Center, and I said, in January,
it's going to get crowded.
I said, you're going to have trouble getting your machines, and it's going to take you longer to get through your workout, but just wait, in about 6 weeks, it'll be back to normal. Because it is. It's going to be. That's been my experience there. When I worked out 3 to 4 days a week for 2 years straight there before I hurt my knee. And January, it was like, oh my gosh, where are all these people coming from? Please hurry up and quit because I know you're going to. Why don't you just give up now? Let me have my squat rack back. So, yeah, I mean, but I'm sitting here thinking, you know, an interesting New Year's resolution for me would be to go, okay, what are my duties today? And embrace them as opposed to avoid them.
I think that's a good thought. All right, well, I don't think we've resolved anything, but I think we have definitely created some food for thought, and yeah. I hope our listeners I've got some ideas from it. And please, if you have some ideas on how this can be addressed, share them with us, either via there's a voicemail system through Spotify, or you can just leave a message. I think we've had one or two people do that already. Left a message on. Any final thoughts on the cigars or drink?
Well, I like the Glenmorangie. I will never turn that down. It's just, you know, I think I mentioned before sort of my house scotch, if you will, is Dewar's White Label, because it's inexpensive and, you know, if people are over that don't really drink it, it's mild enough to be where people will drink it. And if you pour them a glass and they waste it, it's not that big of a deal. But as far as, like, keeping around in the house on a regular basis for enjoyment purposes, I'm real happy with Glenmorangie.
Yeah, I am too, and I don't know how I stumbled across it, but it's definitely my favorite, like, quote-unquote, every day, although it's not every day, and no jokes, please.
Well, yeah, because a bottle only lasts a couple of days, then you're out.
This is the treatment I receive from friends and family.
Kevin's over there trying not to laugh out loud.
All right, well, we haven't talked about it as a group, but I'm thinking that one of the things that we might talk about, Mark doesn't like New Year's resolutions, but it is a fitting time for us to talk about creating a rule of life or a plan of life at the beginning of the year. And prayer is central. So I think that might be what we talk about next week. Not promising that, but that's a possibility of what our topic will be next week. In the meantime, smoke them if you got them.
Spider pig does whatever a spider pig does.